Welcome to Utah Public Radio, and we're just 2 minutes away from Behind the Headlines. Tom Williams here with Madeline Mortensen. So, Maddie, great news this morning with the member drive. We had an Icon health and fitness dollar-for-dollar match for, to the tune of $2,500, and that's been matched just this morning. That's incredible.
It's been more than matched, Tom.
Yes.
I think we've maybe raised almost $7,000 this morning, if I'm doing my math right. And I just think that's so exciting to know that our UPR members are supporting us, because we've still got about $8,500 left to go. Am I remembering correctly?
$8,000. We have $8,000 left to go. We started the day needing $15,000. We're at $8,000. So I use the word just $8,000. Which is, but we can do that with your help.
Yeah, if we got $7,000 during morning edition, I bet we can get $8,000 while you and I are pitching.
That's right. That's right. We're up until noon today, so chipping away at this. By the way, our thanks, sincere thanks to Icon Health and Fitness. They have generously stepped up to the plate here. And thanks to everybody who took advantage of that to match. Now the goal is the overall goal, which is $8,000. We chip away at that. We can meet our overall goal by the end of today.
And I don't know about you, I see it as a little bit of a competition. Like Carrie and Debbie were pitching this morning and they're on development, we're on production. So maybe, you know, we can be the ones that bring in just a little bit more to finish out the member drive.
That would be great. Here's how you take care of your membership, upr.org. Go to our website, upr.org, or you could call 800-826-1495. Your support for UPR in general and your support for Behind the Headlines, which is a wonderful program.
We really are so lucky to partner with people like KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune to bring you great programming and support that here.
UPR.org. UPR.org is the place to go.
Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah News Roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, a member of a prominent Utah family accuses the LDS Church of fraud and sues to try to recoup millions of dollars in tithing. Plus, the increased oversight coming for Utah's troubled teen industry and the bills signed, left unsigned, and vetoed by Utah Governor Spencer Cox. Joining me on the phone for this conversation, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jessica Miller. Good morning, Jessica, and welcome.
Good morning.
Also on the phone, reporter Tony Semerad is with us. Good morning and welcome to you, Tony.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
And Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens. Welcome, Taylor. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Listeners, you can join this conversation by adding your questions and comments to our Twitter handle. You can tweet to @KCPW, or you can call us at 801-355-8255. That is 801-355-TALK. Let's begin with a story about one member of a prominent Utah family, the Huntsman family, and his lawsuit against the Utah-based Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Tony Semerad, James Huntsman, is behind the lawsuit, and I think that listeners will know some of the, you know, Huntsman family tree, but can you tell us who James is and, yeah, what this lawsuit is all about?
Okay, so by my understanding, James Huntsman is the seventh of nine children of industrialist philanthropist John Huntsman Sr., who passed away in late 2018. That would make James the brother of our former Utah Governor John Huntsman Jr. In the rest of the family. He's a 50-year-old California resident, and earlier this week sued the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, essentially accusing church leadership of fraud and deception, accusing them essentially of having made repeated public statements as to how tithing money is spent by the church. According to his lawsuit filed in the Central Federal District of California, he cites a number of occasions where church leaders assure members that these tithing funds, which of course are funds that dutiful members pay 10% of their income to the church,
right,
that money was being used for missionary work and for building temples and other kind of religious work. And his lawsuit refers to an Internal Revenue Service whistleblower complaint that some people may remember filed in December of 2019 before we got overwhelmed by the pandemic.
Right.
And that lawsuit, or that complaint, I should say, points to a large investment fund maintained by the church. This was filed by a former manager of Ensign Peak Advisors. In addition to some other claims that, you know, the church wasn't spending for charitable purposes out of that fund according to law, the filer of that whistleblower complaint also accuses the church of using money from that fund for commercial purposes. Specifically, at one point, he alleges that the church propped up a troubled insurance company, Beneficial Life Insurance, that the church backed, and then also that the church put money into City Creek Center, the mixed-use shopping mall downtown. So Mr. Huntsman wants his money back. He claims that he had been kind of deceived,
right,
that this large amount of money that the church receives from its loyal members each year were being used for church purposes, and instead, at least according to this whistleblower complaint, those funds have been used for these commercial purposes. And it says that he had paid regularly as a dutiful member, as I said, since 1993, and is claiming at least $5 million in damages, and he would like that money returned.
Tony,
now the church.
Yeah, I was going to say. I was going to ask you for their response. I mean, the tithing that is given to a church is essentially donations to a charity, a nonprofit. And if that's the case, I guess, is there much of a legal argument for James Huntsman to try to recoup his donations? Is the question.
Well, a couple of legal authorities on this I've talked to do not feel that he has a very good chance of recovering this money. As you say, these are voluntary contributions, as any contribution to a charity would be, unless there are kind of specific legal restrictions associated with the donation when it's made. There really isn't a lot of legal basis for these funds to be recouped. And, you know, a couple of legal analysts kind of looking at the lawsuit noted that it almost has more of a kind of a statement feel than a sort of an actual legal action. You know, so for example, the standard for proving fraud in California is relatively high, and really the only proof this document offers is this reference to the IRS whistleblower's complaint. And by the way, we have not heard anything from the Internal Revenue Service or from the church that complaint had any sort of significant legs, although the Ensign Peak Advisors, the fund involved, has since started to report to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission its regular kind of investment activities as per reporting requirements.
Sure.
Yeah, so the church, volunteered that Mr. Huntsman had resigned his church membership last year and kind of cast him as, you know, just somebody that wanted his money back, essentially. And the church kind of reiterated statements made by, former church president Gordon B. Hinckley and others that, sort of standing by their assertion that no tithing money had been used to build City Creek, and that, you know, the church kind of refers to funds drawn from other commercial entities owned by the church and earnings from its invested reserves, as opposed to tithing money, having gone to these things. So it's a quirky lawsuit. Hmm. It quotes Brigham Young at one point.
Right.
Sort of invoking the honesty of church leaders, and has little sort of bold and italicized asides that kind of speak. There's a sort of a tone of indignation, you know, Mr. Huntsman, if you believe the lawsuit, you know, feels deceived and feels that other members have been deceived by these, you know, sort of commercial expenditures. And he makes allusion to, you know, if he were to get the money back, he might donate it instead to causes that are marginalized by church policies, you know, involving women and African Americans and the LGBT community.
Tony,
it's interesting to see where it goes.
Yeah, it will be. I a question that I have, though, you know, you talked about the what's you know, if there's much of a legal argument there, and I'm wondering if, you know, if I make a donation to a nonprofit that claims to be doing food aid, you know, for example, for people who are hungry, but instead those funds are being used to create a golf course. Would the fact that the charity had reeled me in with one line make a difference? And I don't know, you know, again, you talked about the $100 billion fund and the whistleblower complaint. Is there any way of knowing, you know, whether or not tithing money got spent on purposes other than charitable purposes?
Well, as to your first question, there is some legal precedent in that regard. I don't know if you recall, there were some disputes about money donated to the Red Cross's effort in Haiti at one point. And, you know, the Red Cross had amassed a large amount of money that it then spent on other purposes, in Haiti and then also outside of Haiti, following the terrible earthquake there a number of years ago. And there were legal actions trying to recover those funds. And essentially the sort of disposing legal language is, were those funds tied to specific restrictions, or were they just sort of made voluntarily to the broad nonprofit organization to do with as it would? And those efforts to recover those funds because of that sort of perceived shift in mission were unsuccessful. And there were a couple of other examples of that too. So in answer to your first question, it sounds like the answer might be no, but the church has, you know, will presumably file a response at some point within the coming weeks, and we'll see kind of where their argument is headed on that. As to your second question, I mean, you know, the exact details of church finances are, of course, opaque. It's a private institution, and it's highly guarded about, you know, where exactly its money goes. So, you know, for tracking whether tithing was indeed involved is a tricky thing, especially I think given this church argument that, you know, what's the difference between tithing and money generated by tithing that's used for church purposes? And you know, there's also sort of a tacit argument that helping out, in some of these cases may help to sort of further the church's overall mission, even if it's not going to temples and to missionary work.
Got it. You know, just going back to that big fund,
Ensign Peak Advisors.
Thank you. Yeah, the Ensign Peak Advisors Fund. That, you know, it's being referred to as a rainy day fund. At first, it was reported as kind of a fund for something that Latter-day Saints believe in, the second coming of Christ. Basically, money for the end of days. Is that line is not exactly what the church is saying the money is for, though, right?
Yeah, I mean they've hedged that. Those allusions were in the IRS whistleblower's complaint, which is sort of a very interesting, morally charged document all of its own. You know, since then, church officials, are saying money in those kind of rainy day protective funds, you know, not only help pay for church operations in poorer parts of the world, but also that it's more kind of a wider kind of safeguard against earthly events, as it were, you know, things like credit crunches and recessions. And it is notable that that if we are to believe the time frame spelled out in the whistleblower's complaint, that the expenditures on City Creek and beneficial life insurance would have come in the window of the general of the Great Recession, you know, when it was pretty common for both insurance companies and real estate operations to be running into financial problems. To your question, that this had been referred to in the whistleblower's complaint as something, you know, the church is sort of getting ready for the second coming, but the church officials have since kind of, you know, backed away or tempered those remarks, as it were, that it's more sort of a wider safeguard, financial safeguard for the church.
Nielsen, from the whistleblower from Ensign Peak Advisors, who filed this complaint with the IRS, his complaint had some people questioning their own tithing. I mean, other people in the broader faith community. And then I guess this James Huntsman, though, is maybe the highest profile example of people, you know, doing just that, questioning how you know, whether or not they're going to continue tithing. He's, as the church points out, he's no longer a member of the faith, though, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. That you know, surely the whistleblower's complaint did provoke some, you know, questions that do persist in terms of, you know, just what kind of transparency there is to these rainy day accounts, and that sort of thing. But Mr. Huntsman is certainly the most prominent Mormon to come along, Latter-day Saint to come along in this regard, and I guess it's a sort of an open question to what extent this might become a lightning rod for some of those sentiments. To what extent he's kind of, you know, carrying a torch, if you were, for other people that feel the same way.
I'll mention, a sort of disclosure that James's brother Paul is the chairman of the Salt Lake Tribune's nonprofit board. Tony, have any others from the, you know, the Huntsman family kind of commented on any of this, or you know, or not?
Well, they've not talked to us. Our reporting about this, our reporting indicates that this is really James Huntsman kind of on his own, doesn't have any sort of official backing from other members of the family.
Tony Semerad, anything else that we are missing from this story, or have we covered it pretty thoroughly?
Well, you know, I think we're there. It'll be really interesting to watch.
All right. Tony Semerad is a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. We are going to take a quick break on the show. And when we come back, we will turn to the bills that Governor Spencer Cox signed and vetoed as the dust settles on this year's legislative session. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, back in a couple of minutes.
Support for Project Resilience programming on Utah Public Radio is brought to you in part by our members and USU Center for Persons with Disabilities, working to create healthy, inclusive communities through innovative research, service, technical assistance, and education. Information at cpd.usu.edu.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on Utah Public Radio. Tom Williams with Madeline Mortensen. I mean, it's an exciting, exciting morning. This is the last day of the spring member drive, and we started the day needing $15,000 to meet our goal. Now we're down to needing $8,000. And so it's been an exciting morning. We want to keep the momentum going.
Yeah, there are so many ways that you can support Utah Public Radio, and we just rely on your financial support because it helps us have the money we need to produce awesome programs like Behind the Headlines. There's always human power involved in everything that happens at the station, and that's why when you make a donation at upr.org, you're keeping us on the air and making it possible.
So this morning's program, a great example of what Behind the Headlines does. They literally take the headlines from that week, and you're able to get insights from the reporters. It's a great program.
I love that, because as a reporter, I know there's so much that just doesn't make it in the story, or so much that if you sat down and had a conversation with me, I'd be able to like give you more color and more insight. And what an awesome way to have some of those top headlines in our state get broken down each week.
This illustrates the fact that this is a community efforts partnership. So it's partnership between Utah Public Radio and KCPW, partnership between you and your local public radio station. So very important.
You know, we do this for you, but we also do it because of you. We want you to have this behind the scenes information, but it's also only possible when our members are an active part of the station, and you do that by giving.
UPR.org is the place to go. UPR.org. I'll say it again, UPR.org, or you can call 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Jessica Miller, Tony Semerad, and Taylor Stevens. It's our live Friday morning Utah News Review, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting to @KCPW. Well, to some of the governor's actions in the wake of this year's meeting of lawmakers, there are bills he signed despite opposition that was mounted to them. Those include bills on the Utah Inland Port and on bail reform. And then there is the bill creating new regulations for Utah's so-called troubled teen industry, and the bill that brings Utah's statewide mask mandate to an end. And then there are, of course, the bills that the governor vetoed. Anyway, why don't we start with an update on something that we covered last week, and government reporter Taylor Stevens, we don't have to dive, you know, very deep here, but last week we talked about the petition asking Utah Governor Spencer Cox to veto a bill relating to the Utah Inland Port. That veto did not happen, right?
Yeah, he did sign that bill into law, and that's the one that would create an infrastructure bank that would help the Inland Port project get off the ground through roads, water, sewage, power, you know, some of those expensive infrastructure type developments that are needed.
And it's a $75 million funds. I guess that those $75 million are now waiting to be loaned out to Inland Port projects, as you said, those, you know, getting it off the ground. How soon might we see those loans going out, Taylor?
Well, it's my understanding that any loans would go to the committee that has been created for, you know, distributing the funds, but also that they would go to the Inland Port Authority Board as well. The port is meeting quarterly. I think their next meeting is June or July, sometime this summer. So I think we're at least a few months away from feasibly seeing any action on that infrastructure bank.
And then, Taylor, we pretty much knew this was going to happen last week when we talked about this, but just to close this out, what did the organizers of this petition have to say about, you know, the petition that was requesting the veto? What did they have to say about Cox signing this bill?
Yeah, so as we talked about last week, you know, they were concerned that this bill was creating a process that was not democratic. They were worried that, you know, these funds would circumvent normal processes, which the port, as I mentioned, has kind of disputed. But in response to signing the bill, you know, they were very critical of the governor, but said, you know, they weren't surprised. Dita Seed, who is an organizer with the Stop the Polluting Port Coalition, said that the governor has supported a number of projects they see as environmentally harmful, including, you know, the Inland Port being one, but also the Lake Powell Pipeline, Bear River diversions, Uinta Basin Railway. And so they said that they hope to have continued dialogue with him. They see him as someone who's open to conversation, but obviously this was a loss for their cause.
Okay. Well, yesterday, Thursday, was a deadline for Governor Cox to finish taking action on bills. We won't rehash the whole legislative session, but we will go through a few. And you know, we're shortly going to have a longer conversation with reporter Jessica Miller about one new law that emerged from the session. But let's revisit the bill on the so-called COVID endgame bill. Taylor, the governor signed off on it, and that means that the mask mandate in Utah is going away, at least the statewide mandate, right?
Yeah, that's right. And that will take effect on April 10th. So the mask mandate is in place until then. But this bill also lays the groundwork for ending some of the other public health restrictions that have been enacted during the pandemic. The governor said at his news conference yesterday that he anticipates on the current trajectory that we're on with vaccines and case declines, that all of those health restrictions will be eliminated by July 1st is what he's currently eyeing at the moment.
If it's interesting, you know, we're all getting vaccines, and that's a good thing. But I was just reading about the country of Chile in South America that has some of the highest vaccination rates in the world right now. They have just again locked everything back down, though, because people started feeling comfortable and kind of jumped the gun, got out there, the virus started spreading again. You know, April 10th is just a couple of weeks away. If the cases start going up, Taylor, you know, if the data shows an increase in spread, Does this bill that the governor signed mean that the, you know, the state health department, the governor himself, they won't be able to reinstate those health measures?
So, you know, the governor has been asked this question a lot because a lot of people are concerned that April 10th is a date that isn't really based on any science. It's kind of an arbitrary date that's the product of some negotiations between the legislature, which wanted it to be sooner, and the governor who, you know, was trying to negotiate some extra time. But, you know, he's been asked this question a few times because we know that we're seeing in some other countries some rises in case numbers and also that, you know, there are more contagious variants that are in Utah. And he has indicated that, you know, the legislature has the ability to call itself into session. He has the ability to call the legislature into session. And if there were a need to respond quickly to, you know, some changes in the situation around COVID, that's likely what would have to happen in order to change some of that. But there are some, you know, requirements in place that would, be some restrictions that apply to businesses and events, for example, the face covering directive, which remains for large gatherings of people. I believe it's over 50. So those would all expire as soon as this, you know, there's a few different qualifications there, one being that intensive care units, are no more than 15% filled. So if we're not meeting those benchmarks, it's my understanding that those particular requirements would remain for masks under that condition, the large gatherings, as well as in schools. But, you know, if there was a need to re-implement a statewide mask mandate or, you know, issue another lockdown order or something on a statewide scale, it sounds like they would need to go back into session to make those changes.
How about local jurisdictions, municipalities, counties, et cetera? Can they, you know, does this prevent them from doing anything?
Yeah, so I asked the governor this question last week, and he actually wasn't sure before he had signed the bill. What we've learned now is that this bill does leave open the possibility for local health departments to issue their own mask mandates if they get approval from county commission or their county council. However, those thresholds I was talking about a minute ago mean that, you know, some of those criteria could be difficult for a county to issue its own mask mandate. So that's something that county administrations have indicated they're looking at. Sully County Mayor Jenny Wilson has said that she's reviewing the law, evaluating the option. And so I think we'll know a little bit more as we get closer to that April 10th date as far as what local mandates might come to replace the statewide one we've been under.
Okay. And in the meantime, health officials are saying, you know, don't jump the gun. We've still got some time ahead of us, despite the fact that people are beginning, many people are getting vaccinated. And it takes a couple of weeks after your second dose for that degree of immunity to set in. I guess we'll see what happens. Taylor Stevens, we're going to move on to other bills. A bill on pornography the governor also signed. This is to block pornography on all smartphones sold in the state of Utah, but not yet, right?
Yeah, I think that's a really important component of this bill that is strange to understand because many bills, you know, when they're signed, they have an effective date, you know, a few weeks. I think it's usually 90 days. I could be wrong on that timeline. But in this case, this bill would not kick in immediately. It would remain sort of on pause until at least five other states have passed a similar law. And at that point, the bill would require that any new device sold in Utah has pornography filters activated at the time of purchase.
If that happens, if five states, you know, do pass legislation that is similar, you know, I know that free speech advocates are concerned with this one. I imagine that there will be lawsuits, and I guess we'll just see what happens and if five other states ever pass this legislation. Taylor, we are going to plow forward onto other legislation, to a bill that the governor did veto, one that has to do with technology as well, but actually with social media. I know this wasn't your reporting, but can you talk about this veto and why the governor decided to veto this particular bill? Actually, tell us what the bill did.
Yeah, so this was a bill that would have put some regulations on social media companies and how they moderate content. And this comes as, you know, many conservatives have raised concerns about big platforms like Twitter and Facebook removing their content. They believe that, you know, the political right is being silenced on some of these outlets, even though, you know, studies have shown that those outlets have some of the biggest audiences online. But what this bill would have done is it would have required these companies to define how they moderate content and inform Utahns when their posts are removed for not following those policies. And they also would have needed to require an appeals process so someone could come and say, you know, I think that based on the rules you outlined, my post should have been allowed to stay up, for example. So that was the bill. It caused a lot of concern among folks who said that it likely was unconstitutional. They, you know, note that the government can't force private companies to carry speech they don't want to. The First Amendment applies to government action. And so Cox, in vetoing the bill, he said that it had some technical issues, but he did say that he thought there were legitimate problems that had spurred the bill and, you know, indicated some interest maybe in continuing this conversation. The bill's sponsor says he intends to revamp the legislation and run it again. So this isn't an issue that we're going to see go away, even as we have this veto on the proposal that was brought forward this year.
It's interesting. You know, the idea is that some conservatives see social media companies as censoring conservative speech, and that kind of emerged from social media companies shutting down the accounts of former President Donald Trump. Of course, Donald Trump was spreading a conspiracy theory about the election, and you know, was that conservative speech, or was that just a conspiracy theory? I guess that's not a question for you to answer, Taylor. I'm suddenly missing our opinion columnists on the show. But how about just in terms of, you know, why Cox vetoed it? He said that it was sort of for technical reasons, right? I mean, it wasn't necessarily that he thought or that he was opposed to the bill itself. I guess you kind of addressed that.
Yeah, I mean, he basically said that he thinks there's valid questions about the impact of social media on public debate. He said, I'll quote from his news release, he said, "Our country continues to grapple with very real and novel issues around freedom of speech, the rights of private companies, and the toxic divisiveness caused by these new forms of connection, information, and communication." So definitely validating some of the concerns, but indicating that this wasn't the right form for that bill to take at this time.
Well, social media companies are getting it from all sides, you know, from the left and the right, because as in Brian Schott's article on this, House Speaker Brad Wilson is quoted saying that those companies, those platforms have become modern town squares where a lot of conversation happens. And then they are also, of course, you know, these behemoth monopolies, which is one of the reasons that the liberal side of America wants to see them reined in. I wonder if there might be some common ground there. Taylor Stevens, thanks very much for covering all of this. And we are now going to turn to another bill that Utah Governor Spencer Cox signed, one that would bring new regulations for Utah's troubled teen industry. And for that, we're going to bring in Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jessica Miller, Justice reporter Jessica Miller. This follows a lot of reporting, Jessica, done by the Salt Lake Tribune, done by you, documenting allegations of abuse and mistreatment and chemical sedation at these so-called troubled teen facilities. Maybe you could just lay out for us what the new regulations that are coming into that will be coming online as a result of this bill. What are the new regulations that we will see in Utah for this industry?
So this was a pretty big piece of legislation, and it covers a couple of different things. It placed limits on when facilities can restrain kids and also requires that those restraints be reported. It gets rid of it no longer allows facilities to chemically restrain kids, which is basically where they shoot them up with some sort of sedative to make them stop moving, essentially. And it also increases inspections to from once a year to four times a year. And some of those will be announced and some of those will be unannounced. And that might be one of, it seems not very exciting, but it could be one of the biggest ways where we see a lot of change in this industry, because we'll see state regulators going into these facilities more often and at times when the facilities don't know they're coming. So it's possible they could be catching some of these problems, some of this abuse that happens at some of these places through these unannounced and increased inspections.
There was, you know, this was a, I mean, cause celeb is almost a pun here, because you had Paris Hilton, a celebrity, coming in and testifying about the mistreatment that she said she experienced at one of these facilities. You know, was that key to this passing? And obviously the reporting by the Tribune that brought a lot of these things to light was key to the legislation, you know, coming into existence. But, you know, did that celebrity lens help, I guess, Jessica?
I think it did. I mean, I was kind of surprised that this it moved through the legislature very quickly and with very little opposition. And so that was kind of surprising, because this is the first time in 15 years that legislators have enacted more oversight on this industry. And so I mean, I guess someone could argue maybe that it's just long overdue, that some of these measures should have happened before this. And I think that there's others that say that there was this kind of Paris Hilton effect when you have a celebrity coming to a committee hearing at the Utah legislature. So it's not the norm of what right. we see usually when these bills are going through the legislature.
Jessica, were there efforts earlier? Say, we won't linger here forever, because you and I have talked quite a bit about this on the show before, and we're getting updates on what happened as the dust settles on the session. But were there efforts earlier to try and, you know, enact new regulations on this industry that didn't happen in previous sessions? And I guess, why did it take until now, if there were? I mean, maybe I first answer that question, and then we can see if there's another question, a follow-up question.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big questions that we all have as reporters, and I've asked a lot of people involved with this legislation, like, why now? Why did it take 15 years? And, you know, there really hasn't been a great answer. I don't think that there's been a bill, like there hasn't been a year's past where a bill has come up publicly and it's been shot down. This is a huge industry in Utah, and there are a lot of people with a lot of ties to it, legislators included. For a long time, there was a legislator in Utah who owned one of these places who was working in the legislature historically. And so kind of going through that history, it is a little bit difficult to find out why it's taken this long for this issue to kind of come to the forefront and for more regulations to be passed.
Your reporting on this keeps kind of rolling out. I mean, you and your colleagues from APM Reports, a reporter from KUER, and others have been reporting on, just today in the Tribune, you have a report on a girl whose hands were zip-tied, who was forced to sit in a horse trough at a Utah, you know, troubled teen center. I mean, are these stories, I'm assuming these stories will keep coming out, you know, maybe incidences will go down, but there's probably a lot of history to dig up still.
I think so. And I think, for a long, I mean, this is, like I mentioned, this is a huge industry. There are, more than 100 facilities and wilderness programs in Utah. And, so I think that there is a lot more to look at here, whether that's oversight as a whole or this industry as a whole or individual facilities that are problematic. I think that we'll definitely be seeing a lot more coverage as we continue kind of looking into this just really massive industry that's taken a hold in Utah.
All right, Jessica Miller, we are going to leave this conversation here, and we will return to more reporting that you did after another quick break on the show. But thank you for all of your reporting on this. Listeners, again, a reminder that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is @KCPW, and we will try to answer your questions or respond to your comments that way. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Will be back in just a couple of minutes.
Support for UPR comes from In Utah, working to slow the spread of coronavirus while supporting locally owned businesses, providing food, goods, and services safely in Utah.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on Utah Public Radio. It originates from KCPW in Salt Lake City. We take it statewide. One of the great partnerships we have with KCPW. And we appreciate our partnership with you. You are our single most important source of funding. And this is, we hope, the last day of the spring member drive. We're counting down, and when we get to zero, the drive is over. Madeline Mortensen joins me.
We're so close, Tom, and it's so exciting. I think what we've been saying is that we've got about 8,000 left to go, which is really doable. We raised about 7,000 this morning during the 3 hours of morning edition, so we can totally get the rest of this done today with your help.
With your help, and here's how you do that. You go to our website, upr.org, upr.org. Click on the pledge button. It brings up the pledge form. It takes just a couple of minutes. Or you can call 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495. You know, Maddie, this is one of the programs I really look forward to every week. It's appointment listening for me. I suspect for you listening as well, because you've tuned in. And now's the time we come to you and ask you for a little support for the program.
You mentioned it's one of the programs that we carry from KCPW. We also carry Both Sides of the Aisle from them. And both of these are great programs that take a deep dive into the Utah issues that you care about. When you pay for UPR programming, you're paying for local programming too, not just the national programming. And I appreciate that variety of perspectives.
And you're paying for the great news reporting that, Maddie's staff does as well. UPR.org, UPR.org is the place to go. Or you can call 800-826-1495.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jessica Miller, Tony Semerad, and Taylor Stevens. This is our Friday morning local news roundup. Join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK or tweeting to @KCPW. And just before we move on to another story from the legislature about bail reform, Jessica Miller, I asked Tony Semerad if we covered the story thoroughly enough for his story that we covered. But on the troubled teen industry in Utah, is there anything that we're missing from that story that that you want to add before we do move on to bail reform?
No, this is something we've talked about a lot on the show, so I think we're good to move on.
All right. Thank you, Jessica. Jessica Miller is justice reporter for the Tribune. We're going to stick with her. And Jessica, one more bill that Utah Governor Spencer Cox signed this week for us to talk about. Last year, Utah lawmakers overhauled the cash bail system in the state of Utah. And in a nutshell, that system let rich defendants walk free while poor people who were accused but not convicted of a crime had to stay behind bars and stay there, or alternatively they could seek out the help with strings attached of a bail bondsman. Bail reform was the fix that was advocated by public defenders and top prosecutors in the state of Utah, and it passed. This year that reform got undone, and the governor signed off on that undoing. Can you talk about why undoing bail reform was a priority for lawmakers this year?
So this bail reform only went into effect in October, but a lot of sheriffs and people who didn't support the reform said that that the reform basically was just letting violent people out on the streets and wasn't keeping dangerous people incarcerated. And so that was kind of the push this year, was to undo the bail reform that had passed the year before, because they said that it wasn't working, that people were being let free, and it was people that maybe shouldn't have been let out of jail.
Sorry about that. You write about the Utah Sheriff's Association sending out a news release this week barely in advance of the governor signing this bill that undoes bail reform. And they were, we think, at least ostensibly, they were trying to put pressure on the governor to sign this bill. What did that news release say, Jessica?
So the Sheriff's Association put out this news release like literally minutes before Cox announced that he was going to sign this bill, where they highlight these two cases where they say it proves that the bail reform didn't work. But the problem with both of those cases, there was information that just wasn't true that they were putting out, that somebody had been released because of bail reform, and that didn't happen. They were not released because of bail reform. They were released because of a court error. And there was another case mentioned where they said a murder suspect was almost released on an ankle monitor, but we went and looked at the court records, and it showed that the judge was given the option to keep the suspect in jail, and he did do that. So there's been a lot of misinformation or misleading anecdotes that have been pushed forward by the sheriff's office and others to try to argue that this bail reform isn't working and that it should be undone.
Yeah, your article has several examples of claims made by proponents of repealing bail reform that end up not holding water. Some scare tactics, I guess, using examples that were, as you said, you know, misleading or inaccurate or maybe even intentionally so. What's to account for that, Jessica? Why so much pressure to repeal this if the data doesn't show that it is causing the kinds of harms that those who want to repeal it are claiming that it does?
I think that's a really good question. I mean, obviously, the stance that the sheriffs and others have taken is that this is about public safety, and prosecutors and defense attorneys, public defenders and others have shown, you know, that the data has shown that the people who've been released more often do as they're told and they come to court and they don't commit new crimes. And so I think there is kind of still the question of why the sheriffs are pushing for this when many of the anecdotes that they're sharing isn't backed up by the data or isn't entirely true.
You talked to the sponsor of the original bill of last year's, you know, bail reform. This is Salt Lake City Democratic Representative Stephanie Pitcher. She talked about this being a misinformation campaign as well. Maybe can you just talk about what she said?
Yeah, so she said that she was, you know, said that this is just kind of the latest in this misinformation campaign that's been going on throughout the session. She's disappointed the governor decided to sign this bill, but he did mention that he would like to call a special session, so she's hoping that those conversations will be productive. But as she said, I'll just read her quote. She says that she's worried that the message is that despite what the data shows, certain groups can achieve certain policy outcomes.
Despite what the data shows, again, which again draws up the question, why was this policy outcome desirable for certain groups if the data isn't there? You mentioned the governor saying that he'll call a special session on this. Why did he decide? Why does he say that he signed this bill?
He admits that the bill is flawed, but he says he wants to call the special session to pass a better law that balances public safety and the rights of defendants who are presumed innocent. So that's kind of his stance on this. So it'll be interesting to see how this conversation continues forward and whether the conversation is productive or whether it's still kind of this misinformation campaign continues.
Okay, and just again, so he's saying the bill is flawed. But I'm assuming that he's saying that the bill isn't as flawed as the bail reform that was passed last year itself, or he would have vetoed this. Go ahead, sure.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's correct. And you know, the bill that kind of came out at the end of the day, there was a bill that just completely repealed the reform from last year, and then there was a bill that kind of fixed some of the problems, and so it kind of came up with this hybrid bill that some legislators pushed against. They said it was a fix-it bill that didn't fix anything, and a repeal bill that didn't repeal anything. So obviously there's a lot of issues here still, and hopefully that will be addressed with this special session. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes from here.
And Jessica, just in the meantime, it's back to the old bail system, meaning now that he signed this bill, we return to what was the original system, which has those same, you know, inequalities baked in.
Partially, yeah. There was one. So when they passed bail reform, judges started looking at things like your risk factors and like, you know, whether you'd show up to court, whether you've had a criminal history, the severity of the charges. Those were the kind of things they had, like a chart that they would use to make these bail decisions. And this legislation undoes that. So I think, yes, for now, we were going back to the cash bail centric model, which, of course, people are very critical of because it allows people who have access to money to get out of jail no matter what, how severe the crimes are that they're accused with. And people who are poor, who maybe can't afford even $2,000, $3,000, $5,000 in bail, they have to sit in jail and wait.
Well, as far as the competing narratives and maybe and misinformation that was happening during the legislative session, you have a quote in your article from House Majority Whip Mike Schultz, who called the confusion a word that I can't say on the radio, a something show. And then he also
I was wondering if you were going to say it.
Yeah, and then he said that the chaos had set off a metaphorical nuclear bomb within the legislature, and it's just been a wild ride. Thanks for covering it, Jessica Miller. I'll ask it again. Anything else to add to this story?
No, I think we covered it.
Great. Fantastic. With that, we've got a little bit of time in the show, so take your time with the underplayed stories of the week, everybody. But that is what we're going to turn to our final segment of the show, where we highlight stories that we didn't cover and that you think people ought to know about. Let's bring Tony Semirad back into the conversation. And Tony, I'll ask you for a pick for underplayed story of the week if you're ready.
Okay, well, I'm not sure if it's undercovered, but it is a whopper. The third wave, depending on how you count it, of federal pandemic relief is making its way to Utah. The American Rescue Plan Act will pump at least $8.3 billion into Utah's economy, right when, you know, we're seeing signs that our state has fared somewhat better in terms of the economic impact from the health crisis. That money's coming towards the beginning of, or the first tranche is coming towards the beginning of next month. Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall just announced $87 million coming to Salt Lake City to be spread amongst a bunch of recovery kind of programs. Similar things going to play out at the state and local government levels. A lot of additional stimulus payments to individuals. The third wave is coming. It's going to start to hit.
It's interesting, and it'll be interesting to see how the money gets spent.
As in contrast to the CARES Act and the Consolidated Appropriations Act, the two prior waves, cities are expected to have a lot of flexibility on this this funding and are going to be able to kind of target funds to programs that might not have gotten money up until now. So it'll be really interesting to see.
Okay. Tony Semirad with, basically some good news there. Let's go to Taylor Stevens with your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week, government reporter Taylor Stevens.
Yeah, so I want to share some news about the Tribune that came out today. Starting today, the Tribune is going to consider requests from people who want their names or their images removed from our past coverage. And this is in recognition of the impact that reporting on those accused of minor or nonviolent crimes can have on those individuals who, you know, may be looking for jobs or, you know, that's always there kind of on the internet. And so a team of Tribune reporters have been working to develop some new guidance and procedures for, you know, how we might change a story. Removal of stories is going to be pretty rare, it sounds like, but we might remove booking photos or provide an update about the outcome of a case. And so just kind of some interesting news, follow some changes some other local news organizations are making on this issue as well. So I would encourage people to check that out on the site at sltrib.com for more information.
Interesting pick. And I'm curious about the guidelines and the process by which that will be done, and if there are any, you know, worries about unintended consequences. But I can have that conversation at some point in greater depth. Thank you, Taylor, for your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. Jessica Miller, we will turn now to you, Justice Reporter for the Tribune. Your pick for Underplayed Story.
So mine is also kind of a bit of a Tribune promo here, but when we're talking about the teen treatment industry, an effort that we released a couple weeks ago, we now have online at sltrib.com/teen-treatment. Anyone can go and look up inspection reports and incident reports for all of these facilities that that we are reporting about. This was an effort that started with a huge crowdfunding campaign. We raised money to pay for the redactions for these records, and it's the first time. It's really an unprecedented look into this industry and how the state provides oversight and regulates it, so people can find that online.
Okay, awesome. Thank you very much, Jessica, for that pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. I'm going to go myself with a story a partnership between the Salt Lake Tribune and the Utah Investigative Journalism Project, looking at landlords putting up roadblocks for disabled renters and even evicting them. It is part of a series of reporting on landlords and renting and the cost of renting in Utah from Utah Investigative Journalism Project and the Salt Lake Tribune. Worth a read. Check it out at sltrib.com. In the meantime, I will say Taylor Stevens, Tony Semerad, and Jessica Miller, all with that newspaper, the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining me today on Behind the Headlines.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Of course, yeah. And Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune and is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Utah Public Radio is in its fundraising season. Be sure to make a contribution to them if you are listening on those airwaves. KCPW's Spring Pledge Drive is coming up soon-ish, but you can always help support this station at kcpw.org. That does it for Behind the Headlines. Here on KCPW, we are an entirely listener-supported, independent, local public radio resource. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org or however you get your podcasts. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from our members and Golden West Insurance Services, dedicated to providing Utah families with customizable options on auto, homeowners, RV, and umbrella policies. Available online or inside any USU Credit Union or Golden West branch from Logan to St. George. Details at usucu.org.
Utah Public Radio is a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan. Also heard at upr.org.